It followed from the special theory of relativity that mass and energy are quite different manifestations of the same thing, a somewhat unfamiliar conception for the average mind. Furthermore, the equation E is equal mc squared, in which energy is thought equal to mass multiplied with the square of the velocity of light, showed that very small amount of mass may be converted into a very large amount of energy, and vice versa. The mass and energy were in fact equivalent, according to the formula mentioned above. This was demonstrated by Cochra and Walton in 1932 experimentally.
What happens when a man decides to cross the blurry boundary of human limitation and steps into his universal creativity? The reward of doing so might hold the potential to accelerate human evolution. A lifelong journey between the spirit realm and science has led Mark Fiorentino to solve Einstein's unified field theory. You are already here, and this is your infinite experience.
One aspect that I wanted to touch on that I wasn't sure that it was talked about, you say that all the universe, all this construct is because of God's intention, because of the power of intention. And that's something that I would love to start with.
Okay. There's really not much to it, because what you're going for is right at the foundation of all reality. And I had to, through my many life experiences, explore that idea. Since I believe in the intelligent design, then there's a creator, and then one needs to know for sure whether the creator exists and the afterlife exists. And through my experiences, I was able to determine beyond any shadow of a doubt, there is an afterlife. There is a God, there is a Jesus, a Buddha, whoever you want, you know, to imagine. So far, spiritual beings and great prophets and so forth, they all existed. They all are there in the afterlife. And I've had many different ways of communicating and having experiences where I was able to obtain information that only I knew. And the other side was able to tell me through mediums or my personal experiences that I had, spiritually speaking, psychically speaking. And there was many experiences that were given me so that I would get evidence and be convinced. So once you know that for sure, it becomes knowledge. And I'm not talking about belief. I'm talking about something more powerful, stronger than belief, knowledge, knowing. And that's the point that I've got to, and that's the thing that I'm trying to pass on to other people. And so the power of intention or God is like the whole universe. We're getting to the point where this physical universe, where we're at now, is perhaps, this is speculation somewhat on my part, that we are in some sort of a mind system, a dream state that God himself created for this universe and all universes. So we live out our lives in experiencing all these things. And that's what it's all about. God's gift to us is our life. What we give back to him is what we do with it. So far as the idea of a creation, I decided that once I knew for sure there was a God, I must try and get information from the source. you want to know how something works, you really want to understand it, you go to the guy that created it and you ask him questions. In my troubleshooting careers at IBM, that's exactly what I did. And I learned from that. Every time something broke, I went to the guy that made it, says, why isn't this working right? You're supposed to work like this, but it works like that. And they would explain it to me. And I realized that's a good way to troubleshoot the problem. So that's how I got to the sort of roundabout way, but not really. I sort of got to the whole idea and the concept, and I built upon that concept. That's where we're at right now.
Einstein said that he wanted to know the thoughts of God, and part of the intention, it's pretty close, right? Like the intention and the thoughts of God. So that was pretty interesting to me. And you mentioned intelligent design and you working at IBM. You also say that you are very good at recognizing patterns. So that intelligent design and patterns go well hand in hand.
Yeah, that's the one thing, you know, because I'm a very ordinary guy. And I will freely admit that. I would say that every physicist out there is probably a lot smarter than me. But yet, an ordinary person has somehow managed to achieve an extraordinary thing. What's in this book is extraordinary. And that's, the you know, I constantly ask myself, how the heck did you figure all of this out? There's got to be an explanation for this. And I thought, well, what did I do? All throughout this thing, I kept spotting clues and patterns. And I was able to take those. I found those clues that were left behind by nature and the masters in physics. And I understood their meaning. Over a lifetime of study, I was able to discern a subtle embedding of a pattern in nature. And I was able to determine its significance. So with that in mind, I said, I'll test myself. Because the one thing I seem to do really well is, discern patterns. So I took an IQ test for pattern recognition, or Rorschach, whatever you want to call it. I took it kind of like 8 or 9 at night and on my lounge chair. I fell asleep twice during it. I still managed to score 141. So I said, I am pretty good at it. I verified it myself. I investigated myself because I want to understand how this came about. You're asking good questions, by the way. So that was, I guess, my key gift. That was just what I needed to do this and to be able to not be swayed by the current paradigm in physics, which would then block my ability to see the truth. Because I think the scientists of this time are blinded by their own presuppositions. And it's blocking them from solving the problem. Let me put it this way. One of the great, great physicists of all time once said to his student, who was Lise Molin, he said, approximately, if all of your colleagues have tried to demonstrate that something's true and failed, it might be because that thing is not true. That's what's happening in physics today. So it's a strange, obscure journey I'm on, because you're right. You know, it takes a lot of guts to go out and do this, because I know I'm going to upset a great deal of physicists, but there are some I've met that are open-minded and are considering and are going to read my paper when I finish it, the one that I'm working on now, a technical paper that I want to submit to a online journal, ResearchGate. This has got to be done. I need to enter into that arena and have them evaluate what I'm working on.
What do you think is the most important thing that scientists neglected? Do you think it's because of the fear of admitting that there is a God or a higher intelligence or somebody above us?
Well, when I bring up that pyramid in that one discussion, what I'm saying, what's going to happen when we evolve to a higher level, we will discover that religion is over science. And they're not going to like that. But, you know, once they drink of that sweet nectar, it will be all right in the long run, because there won't be anything really to be fighting against. It's just the way it is. It's the natural way. If, in fact, and I know he has, because I have many near-death accounts of people talking to God, talking to Jesus, and God outlining and saying, I created the universe, all of the universes, an infinite amount, dimensions, all the laws of science I created. I mean, it goes into great details. Over and over, they pound away at this, and they come back and say this. It's not a mistake. It's not an accident. It's time that we grow up. We evolve and stop trying. We're like little children who are playing and have no idea of where they're at or what they're doing. And they're not seeing the big picture. Scientists are in old school thinking, still struggling with, is there a God or not? They should get beyond that, hopefully, at some point. And understand that God is a universal being. Stop picking, you know, well, humanity keeps making the mistake is they try to say, my religion is right and yours is wrong. No, they're all okay as long as they bring you closer to God. That's the whole point of religion. There are many paths to go to get to a city or a town, many roads. They all get there. It's the same thing with human beings and living. You've got to realize there's more than one approach to coming and having a personal relationship with God. What scientists and most people don't realize now, God not only created the universe, but he's a personal God. So I'm a theist. So I'm saying not only did he create the universe, but he's still actively creating and co-creating with us. And other beings. There's like billions of other star systems with life forms on it. And we're stuck here with, you know, no light speed capability or beyond light speed capability. We're stranded on an island in the middle of nowhere, a little blue ball. And only a few people realize, the government mainly, that there are other beings, and that's being kept from us. And you know, the greater expanse of our consciousness will occur one day when we get anti-gravity and we come to know that there is a God. Because when we start to meet other alien species, they're going to say, yeah, there's a God. It's a universal God. And when one after another comes in there and tells us that, eventually we're going to get it.
Yeah, that's going to be a rude awakening.
Well, I don't know. I look at it as a utopian society that will evolve, hopefully. Mankind has spent way too much time fighting each other, and it's time to stop that. If you want to survive and move on, you got to go beyond that, this anger and this division amongst people. Unite as one. And move forward. And there's so much to explore, so much to learn. We've only experienced 0.0001 million% of what is out there in the universe. So we're just getting started.
Hopefully your book can get us to that stage, because there's a lot of interesting stuff that you talk about in your book and that you've given it a lifetime of thoughts and going over and over it. But before we go into your book, can you tell me about the book cover? Because there's very interesting symbology in it.
Yeah, well, it's all there intentionally, by the way. I've had this weird link with a group called the Moody Blues. You ever hear of them? They're a band. I got the original idea in around 1972, 71, 72, somewhere in there. I saw an album cover and it moved me. So I had that image and I always kept that. Someday I'm going to use that. I know someday somewhere. And So the basic with the old man, who is the master, the student of the master. I kind of feel that I was once that student being taught by a master, and now I am the master teaching hopefully many others. And the symbols, that is the components or the signature of God, which is in my book. And the signature of God was actually something that was discovered by, well, your quote that you made earlier, that Einstein said, triggered the search for the signature of God. I remember reading it. It moved me. Einstein said, I want to know how God created this world. I am not interested in this or that phenomena, in the spectrum or this or that element. I want to know his thoughts. The rest are details. I began thinking about, well, I really want to know how to, you know, can I read God's mind? And it sure would be helpful. He is the creator, and let's ask him. And that triggered this like little short puzzle in my head. I thought the signature of God is everywhere and in everything, but impossible to see. And I thought about that, and it really didn't take long to solve that little riddle. I said, well, it's got to be inside of the atom. God, that's where he signed it. It's everywhere. It's in everything. And we'll never be able to actually look at what's going on in there. So I decided, well, if God wants me to know or us to know, he's going to send that information back through a near-death experience. So I just, on a lark, went on to websites, near-death web, and I started looking. And I knew the thing I was looking for, the signature, would be a dynamical geometry, something in motion, a geometric thing, but I didn't know what. All I knew was it would be composed of three. There will be three elements somehow. So I knew if I found it, it would have three in it. And
I... Why three?
Because there's three quarks inside of a neutron and a proton. That we know for sure. Low scattering experiments, low energy scattering experiments have determined there are three nodes of deflection inside of a neutron and a proton. They name those nodes, those things in their quarks. And it just so happens that they have charges that are equal either to 1/3 of an electron or 2/3 of an electron. So we're all down to thirds here. So I'm looking for a dynamical geometry that's in the center of these particles. And that's how he signed it. That's how we know who did this work. That's what some people call the breath of God. So I begin looking, and sure enough, after a week or so, I find this lady. Her name is Lynn Claire Dennis, and she has this near-death experience. Her and her husband are up in a hot air balloon race over the Alps. They went up too high. The pilot guy didn't realize it, and her brain was starved of oxygen. She died. They had to immediately descend it rapidly and do, you know, life support on her, bring her back to life. And when she came back, you know, she gasped her, pulled up to her husband at the time and said, I've seen this and I saw this. And she said, I saw something immense, powerful. And then she goes in her book. So I read her book to get the details. And God clearly says, I am the energy that forms mass. I mean, he goes, I am the power behind the sun. He's talking about, he knows how he makes matter from the motion of particles. And that exactly matches my theory. So I'm getting excited. And what does she see there? But this thing right here. That is what's inside of neutrons and protons. The quarks are in three areas, equidistant, moving around, and it forms a knot, which is perfect. The knot, the electromagnetic knot, is what holds that system together. It becomes rock solid. It can't be torn apart unless you really blast it with a lot of energy. That's what's the strong force. They They totally got the strong force wrong in quantum mechanics. This is the binding force. And it makes sense, doesn't it? When you look at it, it makes sense. The quantum mechanics model using a particle that never shows up until you blast the hell out of a neutron or a proton and you splatter everything out and you get all these extra pieces. One of those pieces they decided to call a gluon. And somehow it magically is supposed to be holding things together. It's not right. This dynamical geometry, which, by the way, those three quarks inside of there are moving at 99% the speed of light in this configuration. So I just now finished this week some videos that I'll be putting up on my website showing what I've seen in my mind for many years that it will be so that people can visualize now, because that's the way I work. I visualize things, what is actually going on inside of the atom. And that's what that book cover is all about. Those three things is the trefoil knot and the triangle, which represents the three dimensions of space. The knot represents the three quarks moving at 99% the speed of light. The sphere, the final part, is what happens when this thing that's zipping around here, the three quarks making the trefoil knot, well, it's rotating as well, and it's precessing. And the end result of all of that motion combined is a spinning sphere. And I link that. See, there's a link here. There is a pattern. So why would a spinning sphere create mass? And I get it from Einstein. So now I'm going to link that for you. So you get that. So you get what I'm thinking. So I'm all looking for this because I'm basing it on this. One of what is called Einstein's happiest thoughts. This is from the book from Amir D. Excel, God's Equation. Einstein followed the line of reasoning that began with the happiest thought of his life. Still at the Swiss Patent Office, he conducted one of his famous thought experiments. Einstein imagined a circle spinning in space. The center of the circle did not move, but its circumference was moving quickly in a circular direction. Einstein compared what happens in several reference frames, a standard model, a standard tool he had used in developing the special relativity theory. Now, this is important. I underline this one, this statement. He concluded, using his special relativity, that the boundary of the disk contracted as it spun. So not only does the boundary of a disk contract as it spins, a sphere, all of it, all around it, contracts inward. So you can imagine arrows pointing in every direction as that space physically is pulled toward that sphere. And when you add that with all the particles together, you get mass and you get gravity. And so I'm linking the clues together to build the model. So now I have the model. The model is in the book. And I clearly go over it. The only thing left to do is to establish the fact that the ether does exist, because to unify the forces of nature, what has to be done is this. You have to do what Einstein set out to do. And basically, if you're going to make a unified field theory, you're going to solve this sentence, this one problem. Electromagnetism and gravity emerge as aspects of a single fundamental field. So the fields, the forces of nature, are really just different types of bending and stresses and tensions in a material substance, the ether.
When I heard you talking about the ether, when you mentioned it's a substance, I imagine it like as a liquid. Acceleration contracts the mass. I thought about the Bernoulli pressure equalization.
Well, pressure is key, and that is also addressed in the book. But one thing you don't have right, it's not a liquid. Scientists back in the 1700s and 1800s, they went through, is it a gas, is it liquid, is it solid? They went through all the different things, and it's not a liquid, and I'll tell you why it's not a liquid. Because you can't get particles to persist. What do I mean by that? They don't dissolve into nothing. You can't build stuff out of a liquid that has a structure. It has to be, if the substance has to be a solid. And in this case, they were able to determine, Einstein and Lorentz and Maxwell, was that it's a quasi-elastic solid. And what does that mean? Sometimes they also use the phrase quasi-rigid, which means basically, if you have an elastic and it's a quasi-elastic, when you stretch it by some force, it'll snap back into place when you remove the force. And a solid means this. It's continuous. Don't think of it as like wood, steel, metal, iron, nothing. It's just something that's continuous. And so when we look at it, we can't really see it. You look into outer space and it's transparent, but it's there. And it's a continuous substance. Einstein argued that if one believed wholeheartedly in the basic idea of a field theory, matter should enter not as an interloper, but as the honest part of the field itself. So particles are nothing but fields within the fundamental field. And these fields in the electrostatic field, the magnetic field, and the gravitational field are just different types of bending of space. An electrostatic field is a twist of space. It looks like this, a vortex shape that grows as it twists all the way to 180 degrees. When that thing moves, space turns around it. That's the magnetic field. So the motion of the electrostatic field causes the magnetic field to emerge. That's Maxwell's theory. That's two-thirds of the way solved. Motion was the key linking item. Charge has to move in order for magnetic fields to exist. That is a common known fact.
In spirituality, they say that when God created everything, the first thing he had to do was to move, to create an action. And that relates a lot with what you say about all those fields.
Well, Einstein said, nothing happens until something moves.
Right.
And people don't get that. They think, well, that's clever. You know, but it's more than clever. He really understood the cause of reality. Without motion, if charges didn't move, and in my book, I tell you why they move. I broke the code there on explaining why particles have autonomous motions. They move perpetually, forever. How the hell do they do that? Well, I had to figure that out. And that's where pressure comes in. And I describe that in high detail in the book. But without motion, everything would disappear. The universe would go black. You wouldn't have light anymore. You wouldn't have mass because without motion, accelerated motion, the mass dissipates. Everything goes to undetectable. Nothing would be observable. There would nothing that out there, you wouldn't be able to see anything.
Or what scientists were doing was looking into the light, into what they can see, but relating it to the ether is that what we cannot see is what's holding everything.
Yes, the ether was a very well-designed object. It has to be transparent or the universe breaks. Why? Well, if the universe were to impede light, then the universe would go dark again because you wouldn't be able to see far away stars because the light would attenuate over the great distances until it would be just nothing but blackness out there. And then the light coming from the sun, if it were attenuated too much, we wouldn't get enough energy to heat the earth. And it would be a very bad system. The system as it is was designed perfectly. Light can go through space, any amount of space, unattenuated. It never loses energy. And it can go for billions of light years. And it has. And every time we look up at our telescopes, we have evidence that that is just exactly the way it works. The way it was designed, it's a perfect system.
Right. It was just a matter of discovering the medium on which light moves.
Yes. In the book and in my studies, I worked on understanding the properties and the methods of the ether. There's so many questions around it. It confuses so many people, mostly because of two things. The Michelson-Morley experiment, which failed to detect the ether wind, and Einstein knowing about that ahead of time, then put special wording in his special relativity to steer everybody away from the idea that there was an ether, because he didn't want his theory rejected. And we know that he knew ahead of time. So that's very important to understand that the historians have clearly found speeches that he made, and it's in my book, writing in his special relativity, distancing that theory from ether theory. But it's very important to know the Lorentz transformations were generated using an ether model. And Einstein believed in the ether all the way up until the Michelson-Morley experiment. So then I was forced to analyze why did they not detect an ether wind. And it took me many years. I had to keep reading and thinking and reading. And the answer is actually right in special relativity. The design of the experiment was wrong, but they had no way of knowing that, because they thought that the motion of light would be dependent on the emitting source. In other words, if I'm on a train and I'm holding a flashlight and, you know, I'm moving in this direction and I shine it, they were thinking that light plus the motion of the train would be the speed of light. If I shine that light, no matter which direction I'm moving in that train, the speed of light is the speed of light. Going back and forth. It's not going to change. And it took me years to understand, why is that? It's because light speed is not dependent upon any external force to the photon particle. It's generated within the particle. So it's determined, its motion is purely determined by its structure. And that means the medium affects the speed. So its speed is absolute relative to space, a stationary space. And so no matter how we are moving in the universe, we can do this experiment over and over again, and they will not detect any motion, ether wind motion, because the particle is always going to go at the same speed. So the design of the experiment was wrong. It's not that they made a mistake in measurements. The measurements are flawless. They're perfect. The speed of light is the same no matter how fast we're moving or not moving through the Earth moving through space. So once I realized that, this whole interpretation of special relativity is incorrect now, because he had to make up this kind of a last-minute explanation that it's really relative. This relative to that speed is what's really important. And to make the equations work, they always zero out one of the frames of reference of motion. They say, well, this is zero, and now this one accelerated, or this one is moving this much faster away. The clock will move at this certain rate. There'll be so much compression if this guy looks at this guy. That's all wrong. And if you tell a physicist about that, they get very upset. But the truth of the matter is, those transformations were really first brought into the world by Lorentz, and he was working on discovering what happened when an electron moved through space. And then he discovered that it compresses, its mass increases as it gets toward the speed of light. These are real physical changes, not relative to some other moving object, relative to space itself. So that's a big argument that I get into with people every once in a while. And the only way we're going to get out of that argument is to prove my theory right And in the back of the book, I say, hey, general relativity and quantum mechanics really don't predict anti-gravity. I say it works. I tell you how it works. Now I'll tell you what experiment to do to prove it. Now do it. And we'll get this done and we'll move on. So that's my, I guess you'd call it a power sweep to to try to get this thing going so humanity could start building any gravity device, hovercrafts and stuff, which is very important for us to achieve that.
Right. Also, the sleep wave that could make possible for us to travel almost at the speed of light, correct?
Much more than that.
How much more?
Any speed you desire.
Oh.
Basically, my book is really kind of a back to the future scenario. I keep going back into the past and finding the clues that were left behind. So what determines the speed of light? I'm going to ask you, you're probably not going to know, but I'm going to tell you, so don't worry. Do you have any idea what determines the speed of light?
No.
Most people don't. What determined Maxwell, James Clerk Maxwell, an incredibly brilliant physicist, scientist, came up with a formula. Was basically, he figured it out the same way they figured out the speed of sound, having to do with pressures and tensions and densities in the air. Well, he kind of did the same thing, but he did it for light. And the end result of that is an equation that goes like this. C, the speed of light, is equal to 1 over the square root of permittivity times permeability. That's why the speed of light is the number that it is. So then you're going to ask me, well, what's permittivity and permeability? Those are two types of properties of a physical space. In his time, he was sure there was an ether. So we're talking about the physical properties of the ether. So in order for there to be an ether, there has to be physical properties. And sure enough, if we go out in the middle of outer space and measure it, it'll have so much permittivity and so much permeability. Permittivity is like, has to do with the electrostatic field and how it builds in space. And it's sort of like an impedance to the electrostatic field. And permeability is the magnetic part. So we have, light is an electromagnetic thing. It's a charge moving with a magnetic field moving around it, right? And you have to know those two things. So now they have a certain quantity. They have a value, very small. And the smaller that value is, the faster will be the speed of light. The larger those two numbers are, the slower the speed of light. So now I'm saying to myself, you know what? Speed of light really isn't constant. So that triggered another research project. I went out to see if anybody noticed that the speed of light was slowing down or speeding up. And what would make the speed of light slow down or speed up? Well, in space, it would be introduction of more gravity. And we know for a surefire fact that if a light beam goes through a gravitational field, which is a contraction of space, it's literally denser, that light beam will slow down. This has been proven experimentally. That is a correct assumption. So now I'm thinking, well, they're saying that the galaxies are moving apart, you know, things are accelerating out there. But I wasn't sure I was going to buy into that yet. So I went around and I looked for slowing the speed of light or increasing. I found this guy who did some research on it, and over the last two centuries, he found that the speed of light is slowing down. Of course, nobody wants to listen to him. The poor guy, trying to think of his name now, he's not in good health at the time, unfortunately. I had a little bit, I communicated with his wife some, but his work basically showed that over time, in little increments, speed of light is slowing down. So that told me the universe is collapsing. It's not expanding. So then I had to figure out why are the scientists seeing these galaxies accelerating supposedly away from us? Well, the truth of the matter is there's several hundred galaxies around us that are not accelerating away from us. Andromeda, for example, We're colliding with that. We're going to hit it eventually. So why isn't that one accelerating from us? And why is there several hundred others with us all moving in the same direction, accelerating toward something? Then I found out what it was accelerating toward. They call it the great attractor. Something out ahead of us is pulling us toward that area, all the galaxies. And when we get there, it's going to be over. And then if you look at the bigger picture, there's these giant black spots all over the universe. And these galaxies, if you look at them, the astronomers who people aren't listening to right now are looking at them, they see groups of galaxies moving this way, another group moving that way, another group going that way. They're falling into these things. So the universe is, in fact, shrinking. It's collapsing. And that's a natural thing to happen. And so that matches what the other guy saying. Since they're all collapsing and all these black holes are coming together and all these neutron stars are crashing, and it's basically creating a thicker, denser universe. And so the speed of light is slowing down. That matches that guy's experimentation, that guy's research. So now we have a new theory that's in my book, Cosmology, that explains why the speed of light is slowing down. So you asked initially, you want to know, can we go faster in the speed of light? Yes. And how do we do that? We adjust permittivity and permeability of space. How do we do that? We use a magnetic field. Because a magnetic field in the slip wave, and I go into great detail in the book, is a rotation of space. And if you look at what happens when you twist something like that, space becomes thinner. It actually expands a little bit. So if you imagine something like Silly Putty and you put it on a little comic strip and you look at the picture and you start to twist it, look what happens to the picture. It pulls apart, twists until the whole Silly Putty just breaks. It becomes thinner and thinner and it breaks. Well, that's kind of a quasi-elastic solid of sorts, more elastic, not so quasi. But space is doing the same thing. So you have to drop the density of space. Less space means faster speed. I can go into it more, and there's more simple math involved. But basically, every time I do a different type of math, you know, like distance equals rate over times, if I change the physical metric of space, if I make it drop, that means that from point A to B, let's say I have a ruler and I hold it in outer space, there's so much substance of space in between that. If I reduce that amount of substance between those points, I can go faster. Light will actually speed up and go faster if I reduce that amount of substance in space, the metric, the actual physical distance. So you go inside of a slip wave and you stretch it and pull it apart. So now you have something that's almost nothing. And so if you can make your distance equal to zero, you can go infinitely fast. And people have succeeded in adjusting permittivity and permeability. And I discovered that on ResearchGate with their what they call metamaterials or left-handed materials. And they claim that they've dropped the permittivity and permeability to zero. And they claim that when they shine light inside of it, it goes infinitely fast. So everything I'm saying is doable. And we noticed a certain wrecks that people have gotten from UFOs claim that the hull of the ship is made from a metamaterial. That's no mistake. They haven't made the cosmic connection yet. But if you want to build something that can go really fast and not suffer from inertia, you make it out of a metamaterial. That's perfectly understandable. Doesn't surprise me at all why the hulls of interstellar starships would be made from that material.
So not only the material, but the mechanics or the machinery inside would assist in traveling at that speed?
Basically, while that helps, that alone isn't enough to keep that starship safe. Traveling toward the speed of light and beyond the speed of light is extremely dangerous. If you don't do it right, you'll have something called inertial leakage, and that'll kill you. And beyond the speed of light, that'll wreck your ship in an instant. So what do I mean by that? I mean that you have to have a warp field, and the warp field is a slip wave. The slip wave surrounds the whole ship with an intense magnetic field, a gradient field. So you have a strong field here on this ring. Let's say you have a cigar-shaped craft. And then the next ring is stronger magnetic field. And the next ring in the middle is even stronger all the way to the end. And when you configure it in a gradient field like that, you'll give that ship not only that ship anti-gravity, but it'll have a velocity. It'll move in this direction. But everything in that starship must be inside of that field, because there's a secondary field, the anti-gravity field, which I call the inverse hyperbolic field. That field cannot be shielded. So what do I mean by that? Magnetic, you can't be hanging out in a really strong magnetic field. It's bad for your health, especially if you got any kind of metal on you. So the inhabitants of the ship have to have a layer of shielding on the inner part that blocks and shunts the magnetic lines of force into metal. So they'll have a ferrous material, and then they'll have another layer maybe of a diamagnetic material that actually reflects so you use both of them together to make an inside environment where the magnetic field is all around the ship, is twisting and stretching the space out so that comes into the ship. That lack of density comes into the ship. So now you're just floating. You can't feel gravity underneath you. It's totally shielded from below. So they can go any speed. And you see UFOs doing this. They go 10,000 miles an hour like this and then stop and then turn. We would not survive that if inertia was present inside of that ship. My method shields from inertia. Their method, it's the same method there, I'm sure they're using. And there's been lots of evidence of people sighting UFOs with huge magnetic fields around them. I'm just going with the evidence. I'm just linking it all together and explaining why they're seeing ships with them. One guy was looking at one through a polarized lenses, and he saw bands, polarized light. And that only happens when there's a really, really strong magnetic field around it. And I remember reading as a kid, the Air Force bringing magnometers to landing sites. And I'm thinking, why are they doing that? They know something. Magnometers are devices that read the intensity of magnetic fields. So they brought it to one website, and they sampled the ground and the grass, and they found that the grass was magnetized. That takes an immense amount of magnetic field. So again, I've linked the evidence I'm finding over my years of reading to make sense into something, into a theory that makes sense. And that's why you see a lot of these starships that they see, they're cigar-shaped. It's the perfect shape because you can make the rings concentric and everything. You won't see like on Star Trek with all these things sticking out here and there. That spaceship would never work. You got to be a simple geometry, a sphere, a cigar-shaped, maybe a triangle shape. Simple geometries where you can encase the whole thing inside of the slip wave.
Makes a lot of sense to isolate the effects on the inside so we're not subject to G-force, right?
It has to be. Well, you couldn't go beyond the speed of light. If you don't do that, if you use rockets to go to the speed of light, which would take the biggest rocket in the universe with all the energy that we could muster to get to the speed of light, you would be pinned back in the chair like this. Again, physicists would argue with that, but I'm saying you'll have a real serious inertial problem when you're moving at that rate of speed, because you have all the atoms are engaging with space as you're moving toward, through it. that can't be ignored. And you would have a compression. Your ship would be flattening, really flattening. Your clock would stop. This is not a scenario you're going to survive physically. So the slip wave eliminates all of the Lorentz transformations I just described. The contraction of length won't happen. The clock won't stop. And actually, the clock will actually run a little bit faster than normal. And you won't have any inertial mass buildup. Your ship will be as light as a feather. And it's perfect because it has to be that way, or you can't break the light speed barrier.
So the clock will be moving faster because it contracted, right?
Yeah, those are the Lorentz transformations that are in special relativity. What I'm saying is going to happen is that those things really happen to you if you're in that. It's not a relative thing like they say about today. Well, if you look at it, it looks like it's shortening, but it's not really. No, really, it's shortening. And really, their mass is increasing. And if they go fast enough, they'll see it and they'll feel it. And their clock will actually slow down and they'll be looking at it. And if they could look at the other one back on Earth and, hey, my clock isn't hardly moving at all. Well, that's because you're moving faster relative to the spatial background.
Right. But that doesn't mean that we could travel back in time with that mechanism, right?
No. Time travel, I get into in the second to last chapter, I think. Yeah, you don't travel through time using a slipwave bias drive. Time becomes absolute. What do I mean by that? I mean, a second for you is a second for everybody else, basically. Your clock is going to move slightly faster, and it's going to move in a way that it's going to basically be very closely synced with everything that's moving very slowly in the universe. When you disconnect from space, your little particles in your body and your clock, they can move a little bit faster. And so then time is going to move a little bit faster. Not really time, because time isn't a real thing. But the clock speed is going to be faster. And so you're not going to go into the future. You're not going to go into the past. You're going to say, I want to go to star A. Star A is 25 light years away. I get in my starship. I break the light speed barrier by 50,000 times. I get there in 15 minutes. 15 minutes Earth time. 15 minutes ship time. Just like on Star Trek, there is no time problem here. So I get there in a very reasonable amount of time. I explore the planets there. I find a planet we can move to, we can go to, we can move stuff to, we can colonize, whatever we want to do. And we can get there in 15 minutes. And then I go back, and it takes another 15 minutes. So 30 minutes, no into the future, no into the past. If you want to go travel, if you want to time travel, I don't recommend it, but you have to use a Stargate. And I describe how that mechanism works. It's a highly speculative chapter, I admit, but I had some clues given to me by somebody in the know. And when I looked those things up on the internet, I was able to use the components to mock up a design. So how can you go into the past or the future? This has to be true. All time is happening at the same moment. If that's not true, you can't travel into the past and into the future. Because what you do is you open a portal. And you pass from this time segment into whatever time segment you want to go into.
You hear that a lot with people who had NDEs. The time is not linear as we perceive it, but it's just everything's happening at the same time. And that's really hard to accept the idea.
Yeah. Well, supposedly the USA has built these things already. I don't know. I have no personal eyewitness testimony, or I've not seen anything, but if it could be done, I describe the way and what types, and it comes with the metamaterials again. They have to be used in the frame of the Stargate. The metamaterials allow the energy, and probably would be photons, to travel at any speed you want, which would compress their frequency to ungodly, ungodly short frequencies. That when they come out of the frame, there's a literal electromagnetic shock wave into the space as it's projected out. And if you combine that with, you know, high frequency sound or something, I'm guessing that you can open a portal because you get that whole area to vibrate at a specific rate of frequency that coincides with some other dimension, be it time or space dimension. And if you know how to compute that physics, which I think would be fascinating for the people who are working in that industry, if it in fact actually exists, you can do all kinds of nifty things. You can go into the past. You can go in the future. I don't recommend going into the past because it creates paradoxes. It's dangerous. It could really mess things up. But you can certainly easily go into the future. That's my theory on that. I did put it in the book as a kind of a last idea that I thought, well, I'll touch on it.
Yeah, you had a very particular experience with what people call spirit guides.
Right.
They tend to see in the future, to see what's going to happen and kind of warn us or steer us into safety. Can you tell me a little bit about that experience?
I don't believe in spirit guides. I know for sure they exist. So again, this is not a belief I have. This is a knowledge. And so I like to tell people that everybody has them. Whether you know it, whether you believe it or not, they're with you and they're sitting right by or standing right by you right now and me and every other person on this planet. So with that in mind, we all get them when we come to Earth. I've sensed my spirit guides and they come to me in times of need mostly. And in one case, they saved my life. So I'll give you that experience. And again, it's evidence that goes in my head when I experience, you know, how do we get knowledge? We get knowledge through experience. So I'm driving home from work one day from IBM by myself in my car. And I have a choice I can make every day. I drive to this road and it's a T intersection. I can go left and I can go through the quiet, peaceful roads, or I can go right. It's a little bit shorter, a lot more traffic, a lot more traffic lights. And most of the time I go left and I go the more relaxing route. So I'm thinking this in my head as I'm approaching the intersection. And as I'm thinking that, I hear a voice say, "Don't go that way." And now I'm not talking. I hear a voice in my head. I hear it like there's somebody right next to my ear. So I turn around real quick and look because I think there's somebody in the car because I heard a voice. I didn't, you know, think it. And I just shook it off and I said, that couldn't be. So then I said, I'm going left. And it says again, don't go that way. And I turned around, I looked again and I said, I definitely heard a voice here. So now I got to make up my mind. So, okay, why would they be warning me? There's probably some danger ahead. But being a person who's a real skeptic of things, believe it or not, I did what would be very unwise. I went that way. Yeah. Why? Why would you think I would do that? Knowing that there's probably going to be something bad going to happen.
Curiosity.
Yeah. I wanted to know what just happened was real. I needed more proof. So I went that way and I didn't hear the voice again. So I'm driving real careful. I try to get behind a van. You know, I'll get, you know, the whatever's coming is probably going to come hit me head on. So I'm looking ahead. I'm aware now. And sure enough, about 3/4 of the way home, I'm on this real straight stretch of road. And I see this truck, pickup truck, and it's going out of control, crossing over into the oncoming traffic lane, going back off the road, crossing over into that lane. It's doing it over and over. And finally, it's getting up to where I'm at. And the guy in front of me, he just turns and steers off the road. And there he is coming at me. So I turn the rail as hard as I can. And I go spinning off the road. And then we just miss. And then he finally stops, spins and stops and sitting sideways in the road. And then I said to myself, the next time you hear a voice saying, don't go that way, don't go that way. And I felt so bad because I didn't listen to somebody that was trying to help me, was trying to save my life. And I went and did what I wanted to do anyway, which was stupid and wrong. And to this day, I keep apologizing to them for not listening to them. And that's a mistake a lot of people make. They just don't realize it. It's not as dramatic as that.
I see. Have you given any thought to how these spirit guides manipulate the electromagnetic fields so they can communicate with us?
That's a good question. And yes, I have given that thought because I'm curious like you. And all I can tell you is when I asked once somebody who was in the know about these sort of things, spiritual energy is not like our energy. It's something different. And I'm going to guess here and say it has something to do with a consciousness that can affect physical things, but itself not physical. It's something, so there is a consciousness and energy. I don't even know what they would call it over there, but I bet you they have a name, and I would love to know what it is. But that spiritual energy, what everybody is composed of on that side, is not like matter and energy here. It's got something more to do with a consciousness or something, you know. And there, my mind just goes into gray. I can't penetrate beyond that.
Have you gone into the rabbit hole of what is consciousness?
Yeah, sure. I have, as a matter of fact. And I have a good definition for earthling people. Our consciousness, it's a miraculous thing. First of all, you have to realize that the brain is not the center of your consciousness. It is an interface mechanism. Your consciousness, when you're born or just before you're born, goes into your body and it is bound to the flesh. And that's done by God all over the universe. That's part of the miracle of life. And in so doing, once you're bound to the flesh, you're in the meat suit here, you have limitations that are caused by the limitations of your physical form. The human brain doesn't have a whole lot of abilities, you know, basically with psychic stuff, and some psychics have some abilities, but when you're out of the body, you can move at any speed. You can go back and forth through time. You have all these miraculous powers, right? And people can be healed by the spirit and so forth. But when you're in the flesh, your consciousness, your soul, the same thing, in my opinion, is bolted physically into the mind. And the mind, the brain, is a physical interface that houses your sensory organs, eyes, ears, and is translating all these sounds and energies into quite literally something that your consciousness can then access and understand. So it's a miraculous thing. There's a physical part, and the physical part interfaces to the spirit. And as long as you're alive, you're bound by this mechanism. And so your limitations, how well you can see, how well you can hear, is really determined by your physical makeup. So you're throttled down when your consciousness, your soul, is in the body. And then when it goes out again, it expands to full power again. So that to me is what consciousness is. It's the soul bound to the flesh. And in that state, you have many limitations. And that's by design. That's not an accident.
And in this physical game, what do you believe that aliens have to do with us? Because we've heard that there is aliens working with the government. There is different types that come here and contact people. But what do you make of with that interaction? Why is that there in this game?
Well, there's more than one alien species, and each one may have different motives, needs, or whatever. And of course, we have our own selfish needs, I'm sure. And there may be, they have made deals. Who knows? I am not privy to any of the inside information. Anything I would say would be pure speculation. I'd like to acknowledge that right off the bat. But just using logic and deduction and, you know, from what information, you know, I have come across. Yeah, I think they've got some collaborations. Certainly, there is one species of aliens that are using humans for breeding purpose. I don't particularly like that idea because the humans are, it's not voluntary. And they're being abducted, and I don't like that. but, you know, some of the aliens, I think they treat us and look at us like we would look at a cow or an ant and thinking, well, you're a subspecies. You're really, you're barely just out of the woods, technology speaking and consciousness speaking. You're really, you know, you're almost just, you know, like a monkey or something. And they feel that we can experiment with you like we experiment with lab rats. But there's other ones that are much more tolerant and compassionate. And, you know, they're just here exploring. And they maybe have a base here or something. Because all species on all planets, you're not going to be safe just on one planet. You have to bilocate. Because tomorrow our sun could go supernova, or it could start turning into a red giant. Its output could double or something and cook everybody here. Or we could be hit by a great asteroid or something and be over. You have to be on another planet or more than one. So everybody, the first order of business, once you get greater than light speed starships, is you colonize somewhere else. And there's probably loads of spare planets that, you know, really don't have any advanced life forms on them that have air and so forth, and we can terraform or whatever, we could start a colony on it. Mars is one, but Mars isn't far enough away. It's in the same star system. You have to be on another star system. And if we don't do that, we don't survive. Sooner or later, the end is coming. And we need to evolve. That's why I'm desperate to get people to understand that we could build starships. And I'm trying to help them do that. And I know the warnings and the dangers of it. I could help them design a safe starship.
Well, we need to get Elon Musk involved then. Do you think he's following the same path as all the other scientists? Like he's
making his money doing rockets. I mean, you know, there's a big business there, and he's done a hell of a job. The guy is a visionary. You got to give him credit for that. I really like learning the stories about visionaries, like the guy that founded Microsoft and the guys that founded Apple and stuff. You know, I love those stories because I like to see how they see ahead technology-wise and create things that people want and need. So I've kind of done that, you know, in my past, but I've never fully realized anything. This is the first time, finally, of all my invention ideas that I've realized. And in order to finish it, I have to build a starship somehow. I have to help somebody, and I have to bring that to the world so that we can find another place we can be safe. Our species can be safe until the end of time, which is going to happen many billions of years from now.
And when it comes to creativity, how is that you get all your information, all your ideas? How do they come together?
Well, it's a combination of intuition and logic and reasoning. And I rely heavily on intuition. It's probably the most important system of gaining knowledge. You can only do so much with logic and reasoning and mathematics and stuff. The mathematics has to be guided by intuition. You have to have the proper model. If you don't have the proper model, the math is meaningless. And it doesn't give you anything worth anything. So in order to really move ahead, you have to be one who sees the future. Let me explain it to you this way. You know, there's all the physicists in the world and they're trying to hit the target nobody can hit. If you really want to jump ahead, you have to be the person that hits the target nobody can see. And basically, that's where I moved to. And I did that through intuition, being willing to admit and submit that there's a higher power, and that higher power, that intelligence, wants to help us and wants to communicate. So, you know, you be open. You know, you can do it through meditation. I did a lot. I emulated Einstein, and I did lots of mind experiments. And I would wake up in the middle of the night, 2 and 3 in the morning, and I would just start imagining. I would start imagining this thing here, right, and how it works. And I would imagine moving at the speed of light as a photon. I did all kinds of experiments in my head. It's a very powerful lab, but it's very inexpensive.
Right. Yeah, many people access the subconscious or the most intelligent part of us, either through dreams or astral projection, or they use psychedelics or certain substances. Have you tried any of those?
No, I don't want to break the mind by, you know, dangerous experimentation. So I've tried to stay away from alcohol. Do I have a little alcohol? Yeah, a little bit every now and then, a beer. I don't use any kind of pot or any kind of other to, you know, supposedly expand the mind, because it actually does more damage than good. What I do is just try to quiet the mind, quiet the ego, because this can't be about me and being right. This just has to be about finding the truth. And the truth is the only thing that's important. And when you find it, you tell it to other people so that they can know the truth and they can work with you to have some great applications like traveling beyond the speed of light, you know, going to other planets. I mean, there's a lots of nice things you can do. And you just do this and, you know, I trust in the spirit, and you know that they want to help me. I've literally prayed and had my prayers answered. Now lots of people pray, and why? I'll give you an example of a prayer that I had answered, and it was in a very sad time in my life, and a very anxious time, and I was by myself. I was going through a divorce, and I asked a question that you asked earlier about, you know, how can we see in the future? And it's not like a big prayer, like a lot of people pray for, you know, please save my father, he's dying, you know, can you, you know, and those prayers get answered. And most of the time it's with a no, but they do get answered. They are all heard. And I've heard NDEs talk about that. There's a whole group of angels that handle the prayers that, you know, are intermediaries between God and them. And, you know, every prayer every man and woman makes is heard. So I made this prayer to my guardian angels. Can you really see the future? And I went to sleep. And that night I had a dream. And it was one of those lucid dreams. I was in color. And it was just such a simple dream. I'm just walking to work in the morning in the IBM parking lot. And there's a beautiful sunrise coming up in front of me. So I'm walking toward the east. And it's a big parking lot, and I park in a different spot every day. So I have no idea where I'm going to be walking through the parking lot. But I'm walking through the parking lot, and I remember what section I'm in right now. And I look down, and I see this shiny dime heads up on a stripe between two cars. And I just look at it, and then I wake up. And it's the middle of the night, and I says, well, what was that all about? And I fell back to sleep and forgot about it. So I wake up the next morning. It's not in my mind at this point. It's totally gone. And I go into work and I stop. I park my car. I'm randomly in the back part, walking toward the front. And then I see that sunrise and I said, wait a second, I remember this. And as I'm walking, I look down and there's the dime heads up on the white stripe between two cars. I lift it up, I look at it, and then look into the sunrise, and I remember the dream as clear as a day now. I says, well, they just answered my prayer. I just read the future. They helped me do it, obviously. Still don't understand the full mechanics of it, because the future is always in motion. So the further away your prediction, the harder it is for that to be right, because there's a lot of things going on, you know. But it is possible, and I did it, and they demonstrated for me. So they hear you, and if you need to know that, and I needed to know that. I needed the comfort of knowing, you know, and that was more evidence for me to know there really is an afterlife. There really is angels. You really can tell the future, because my future was told many years ago when I was 20. And it had to do with this that we're going through right now. So I was looking for more evidence to say, will that ever really come true? And they took the time to demonstrate. And so this can happen for other people. This could happen for you. If you really need it, you can make a prayer tonight and it'll be answered. It's always answered. Whether you will get a yes or not or no depends on whether it's something you really need, and it's something that doesn't violate things.
Being that we are energy, basically, do you think with our mind we could get to manipulate those electromagnetic fields?
Aliens do it all the time. Yeah, I'll give you an example. There's been many instances where they go over a nuclear site where they got the missiles, the missile launching area. And they start flipping the switches and turn either the system on or turn it off. They're not doing that with a technology. That technology would be very, very difficult to create. I am very confident that's just with pure psychic ability. And you have to realize that these guys are millions of more years evolved than us. And in a million years from now, we'll be able to do that if we survive. If we don't do something stupid and wipe ourselves out, you know, we're already, there's more psychics now than ever, and they're good ones. And I've talked to some of them and they're really good. And you can tell they're talking to the other sides. It's an amazing thing. Be able to talk to your parents again or whatever. So that's just one form of psychic ability. Moving objects and stuff, that comes later on. That's a little more difficult type of ability. But I feel certain if we survive, we'll get to that point. The government already uses psychics. They use remote viewers. Very handy little psychic technology. And they know about it. They don't want to admit it. They love physicists being, oh, that's not real, that's not true. They don't care, but they don't listen to them. They got their own physicists and they say, hey, this is real and you're going to help us do it better. So get on board. And by the way, don't talk to anybody about this, whatever it is we're doing. So you never hear anything in the mainstream physics. They're kind of out of the loop. But the physicists that work for the government, they know all the inside stuff that they're, you know, privy to. But yeah, someday, I feel very confident that there are already psychic healers now.
Right. What do you think you would do if you would get into that position that the government approaches you and say, I don't know, we're going to take care of you and your family for the rest of your lives, but come and work with us?
I don't think the United States government will ever ask me. I think they know everything I know already. It'll probably be somebody else, if it happens at all. And I'd be happy to help. I'm not against anybody. I'm not against my government. I'm not against anybody's government. I'm for people. I'm for earthlings. And I just want to do my bit, my part, before I pass on. And this is my talent. This is the thing that I can do to make a real big difference. You know, it's a dream come true to be able to contribute in a way that helps humanity be a happy ending, a happy place. And this is how I can do it. So if somebody ever asks me, whether it be the U.S. or somebody else, I'd be happy to help out. There are some dangers. I would recommend some special systems be built into the starships to keep the occupants safe from being killed, especially from inertial leakage and things of that nature. There's a lot to be done, I think.
Right, and you're doing a pretty good job. I mean, everything that you talk about and everything that you present is just, like, mind-blowing.
A lot of these things we're talking about tonight, other people are thinking about this stuff. Traveling faster than light, what is the energy like on the other side? What is the spirit made of? There's all these things that people are thinking about, and they never really get to talk about it. But tonight we got to talk about it, and are going to get to listen to it, and we're going to make a difference. You and I are going to make a difference tonight. We have, and we will.
Yeah, that's the intention.
I'm going to tell you something nobody else knows out there in the world of physics, but they're going to find out. They're going to discover it. The sun has a solid neutronium core. Every star has a solid neutronium core. I talk about it in the book. So if you have the book or whatever, read that. You want to learn about that. That's a big discovery. The slip wave's a big discovery. Anti-gravity's a big But that one is something people could really, sink their teeth into, knowing all stars are formed from neutron stars, basically. And it makes sense when you think about it, because gases in outer space aren't going to come together magically by themselves, as we're told now. The pressure pushing out is way stronger than the gravitational pressure in that gas. So there had to be a gravitational source. And that source always is a neutronium core. And it makes so much sense. I had the whole model worked out. It's a beautiful, sensible model. So there's a gem for the show. I don't always remember to talk about that. But put that on there, too. I want people at NASA to start determining if the core of the sun is solid. Hopefully they can do some experiments to prove that.
Excellent. Thank you very much for throwing it out there. And I started looking into quarks and valence quarks and gluons and anti-quarks and the Lorentz transformation law, motion is limited by speed of light. And it was just stretching my neurons.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the bulk of what I did has to do with physics. Overall, I'm a philosopher. I'm a metaphysician. I study the nature of things, pure and simple. It just happens that the nature of things has a lot to do with physics, and it's hard to dodge that completely. But if I talk to a physicist and I say this stuff, they know what I'm talking about. They may not like hearing it because they're told, if you're going to model reality, you have better use quantum mechanics. That was said by Richard Feynman. And that's the wrongest statement that anybody could ever make. That's exactly what's wrong with physics today. You want to do the opposite of what he said there. If you want to model reality, you better use classical field theory. That's what I did. That's what Einstein did. That's what Maxwell did. That's what Lorentz did. And Newton to a certain degree. And I put those guys up against anybody now.
Right. Yeah, they started deviating just a little bit from the basics, and now they're in a completely different plane.
They have lost their grip on reality, and I got to bring them back, and I'm going to have to do it with a lot of them kicking and screaming as I drag them across the finish line. But it's somebody's got to do it. I guess it's going to be me. At least I'm going to try. But there are some nice physicists out there who have open minds and are listening, and I hope I can meet enough of them that I meet somebody like Albert Einstein met, which is Max Planck. I'm looking for my Max Planck, and physicists will know what I'm talking about, because Max Planck was the guy that made Einstein famous. He connected it. He said, hey, this guy's onto something. Look at this. he's the one that brought him in to the mainstream. So I'm kind of looking for that same deal.
Well, I'm sure there's somebody out there. Just that I feel that they're afraid. I mean, they invested so much time into what they do and the way they do it that deviate from that is just...
Yeah, it's, they've made their livelihoods on particle smashing. I mean, that's big business. You know, who doesn't like having a champagne party when they find another particle and maybe getting a Nobel Prize? Unfortunately, finding particles really isn't where it's at. I've said it before and I'll say it again. It's never really been about force and particle-to-particle interactions. It's always been about particle-to-space interaction. That's where force comes from. And till they get that, you know, quantum mechanics works. Everything's based on a particle-to-particle interaction. Those forces need to be thrown out. Strong force, weak nuclear force. They're not forces. They're interactions. Reclassify them. The real forces, magnetism, electrostatic field, gravity. That's it. And anti-gravity, but that's just the opposite. It's still the same thing, really. Just an expansion of space. And those are bendings of space. And space is a continuous object. Those are the real forces. Action at a distance. It's all about stresses and tensions in the medium. It's really simple when you accept it and understand it. It becomes all of a sudden simple. It's like, huh, that makes perfect sense. The whole theory makes perfect sense.
It's so simple that seems complicated. Like Einstein was saying, if you want to travel from point A to point B, all you have to do is bend space. And it's like, how do you bend space? Like, how do you achieve that?
Well, you can't. See, it's a novel idea. But bending space like that using gravity is lethal. You're not going to survive that bending of space. No ship going in there unless it's one of mine, which we didn't even talk about, but on another session, it's possible to send a starship using the slip wave beneath the event horizon of a black hole and survive. It's possible. It's completely possible. I wouldn't want to be the one doing it. I would send a probe first to make sure it works. But it cancels gravity, and since gravity is the thing that's going to destroy you, if you block it out, you can go under the event horizon and see what's there. It's not going to be pretty, believe me. It's going to be pretty black. But that's the technology that I use to talk about the stellar converter, which is a really nifty technology. But that's for another time and another subject, because that's a big discussion. If you want to understand more of what I said, do what I do. When I have something that's complicated, I play it over again, play back this tape or get the book and read it four times. Play it over. Each time you do it, you'll get more comprehension. You go from maybe 20 or 30% to 40 or 50, 50 to 60, 70, 80. I read articles over like Einstein's speech on ether and the theory of relativity. I probably read that 50 times. And every time I read it, I understand it a little better. And I get insights. Oh, of course, that's what he's saying. It's so obvious, you know. But I didn't see it the other 30 times I read it. But every time, I get more. So play this tape back. And, you know, it'll make more and more sense. I promise you. Every time you play it back.